listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys over here to my right. We've got Martin Page.
Hi, Mike.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello, Mike.
And next to Scott, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, Mike.
And next to Bobby, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And next to Andrew, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hi, Mike.
Guys, this is like the fourth show in a row. We're all here.
Woo!
That's it. Wow. Next week, we're not coming.
When it was like
I don't know if Bobby's all here.
I've never been all here.
And you know what? This is show number 30.
Wow.
Show number 30. Bobby, wow. This is show number 9 for you.
Yeah, exactly. That's straight.
He's not
one's my age and one's out of your IQ. Come on, bring it on.
It's good to have everybody here. One thing I wanted to mention is if you go into the newsstands this week or go into the bookstore and you pick up the June issue of Electronic Musician Magazine, on the cover, Scott Gershon.
Thank you.
And if you open it up and you read the article, you will not see one reference to
that audio now.
He's proud of it, isn't he?
Did they end up using that?
Is there any new picture?
He mentions the podcast with the web address and everything.
Wow.
Have you read the article, Mike?
No, he does not.
Yes, he does.
He does.
He says, I take part in a biweekly podcast, and it gives the audionowcast.com address.
Wow. Like, you know what?
So okay. Obviously you haven't seen the article, have you?
Cut, let's start again.
Oh, no, you don't get off that easy.
Wow.
No, it's not Hustler you're looking at. It's
well, because he's on the cover of that, too.
Yeah. Oh, he is, that's right. He's the center spreader of that one.
And if you open it up and read inside, you'll see where the Audio Nowcast is mentioned in the article on Scott Gershon.
So I tattooed it on my what?
That was great, Scott, though. Congratulations. That was pretty cool.
Which swimsuit did you choose for the centerfold?
Oh, you know, that little frilly thing.
Oh, yeah.
The floss.
That'll be great.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Nice.
When was that interview? What was the lag time on that?
Probably about 3 months.
Really? That's a long time to sit and wait.
Yeah. Going, okay, well, how's it going to turn out?
But, yeah, so I just wanted to mention that. So, obviously, I haven't read the whole article.
I was going, oh, man, I do this thing. Oh, why am I doing that?
I just wanted to mention a few other things. I picked up Final Cut Studio 2. I don't know if anybody works with any Apple products, but I picked up the Soundtrack Pro. You guys, mm-hmm. You ever used Soundtrack Pro? You ever heard of Soundtrack Pro?
Sure.
Anyhow, they have Soundtrack Pro too. And, you know, it's getting close. It's going to be nipping at, Pro Tools' heels really quick because it's pretty powerful for one thing, and the way it's integrated into the picture side of things when they make changes and things like that. The one thing you can't do on Soundtrack Pro is you can't move your QuickTime in the timeline. So if you have an OMF that has, 700 regions and you have a 2-pop and you want to just move a second, you move the QuickTime up a second, you can't sync your QuickTime to your regions, to all your audio files.
Are you sure?
Yes.
So you can't move QuickTime against audio?
No,
QuickTime.
Right, but you can't move QuickTime against audio.
You've got to do an offset on the QuickTime. You have to put a QuickTime offset and then it will slide.
You know, we were looking.
You have to put a negative in and then it will slide.
But it won't move. You can move the audio. You can move everything. We're still trying to find how to move the QuickTime. I have a post on the Apple board and everything trying to figure out how to make this work.
Will it accept Avid files?
It'll take OMFs. Yeah, that's the big thing in it.
Okay, and this is the product that's already going to compete with Pro Tools?
No. Well, no, because the crazy thing is everything else is really brilliant. They do some really cool things. But then when you want to do something as simple as just syncing your picture to your audio, it's
there's got
to
be something you can do in Final Cut, though.
You know what? I hope so, and I hope there's going to be some
I hope
answers.
So, too, because I ordered it today. The upgrade.
But I just had to mention that because I was really surprised. So if anybody knows how to do that in Soundtrack Pro 2, just send us an email. One other thing I wanted to talk about is, Andrew, you just finished, well, you not just finished, but you tracked the Linkin Park album, and I wanted to talk a little bit about
with,
that.
With some other folks, let's be fair.
Well, that's true. Yeah, but tell us a little bit about working with Linkin Park and what you did and the tracking and things like that.
Well, we tracked the album at Rick Rubin's Laurel Canyon house, the same one we did the Chili Peppers record in, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and a whole bunch of records have been done there. So we were set up there, so we rented in the Neve console. And we also, for the first time I've been up there, we rented in an API sidecar. So we had 40 channels of Neve, and we had 16 channels of API, which is brilliant. All the drums going through the Neve, all the guitars going through the API, bass through the API. And the thing about Linkin Park is there's six of them, so you're already starting off with a lot of people. And then they all play lots and lots and lots of stuff. So the theory, and we stuck pretty well to it, was to have absolutely everything possible set up all the time. So no matter what anybody wanted to do, they would just kind of wander out. You'd know what input that was at. You had a preamp set up. You had a chain going for everything. You had knew what input in Pro Tools it was, and you'd open up a track and hit record on any song at any time. And it was so it was a huge setup.
But is it a control room studio situation, or everyone?
Yeah, there's it's basically what was a ballroom is the live room, and then there are two smaller rooms at the end of that, and then I think it was a library is the control room. So it's a decent sized control room. The isolation isn't great, but it's pretty good. And then we also had two more rooms set up in the house as well. One mostly just for programming, had a lot of synths, and then a third room all the way upstairs just for vocals once we got into that. So it was pretty huge.
Did they track their synths? Do they play
their
synths?
Yeah, no, they track all of the stuff they do, because then they also do a lot of editing themselves. And so they deal with everything as audio, and they'll start – I mean, they're rearranging songs after everything's been recorded forever. Like, oh, let's try taking a bar out of that pre-chorus. Oh, let's try moving this bridge over here. And so the songs are constantly evolving. So everything has to be audio, and it all moves all the time. And sometimes in all three rooms, there'd be three people working on the same song. And then you got to figure out, well, how are we going to work all that together?
Right.
So it was pretty hairy, but it was good.
Now, when you track, there's a lot of people don't even know the difference between, you know, a tracking engineer and a mixing engineer. Some people think that you do them all, and sometimes you do them all. What kind of responsibility do you feel that you have to the mixing engineer? Is there anything that you just – I mean, is it just strictly keeping –
Nah, screw them.
Compress everything, EQ everything.
Yeah. No, I mean,
do you go for like the cleanest sound possible?
Well,
or do you
want a little
character in there, or how does?
Yeah, I mean, I don't approach recording. I mean, certainly, if I know I'm going to be mixing a project, maybe I'll sort of think about it. But I don't approach recording thinking about what I'm going to do for the mixer. I'm only thinking about what am I doing for the song and what's appropriate for the song. What instruments are we playing? And it's really about getting the instrument right first, then picking which microphone is going to work, and then where is it going to go, and then what preamp is going to be great with that, and then, you know, so on down the line. Personally, I don't process things very much unless I'm going for a really specific sound. So probably 90% of the recording was microphone, preamp, maybe a little EQ, done. I almost never compress while I'm recording. And if I do, it's either squashing the crap out of it, or it's really, really light compression just to contain it. So I don't have to either record at a really low level, because some of the dynamics, like when Chester's singing, the dynamics are insane.
Really?
So you compress a little bit just so that you don't screw something up.
Wow.
You know, it's more of a safety thing than a sound thing, because I personally don't like compressing lots of stuff lots of times.
What about like bass guitar stuff? Are you going direct and mic combo or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and even with – and not just on Linkin Park, but on every project. Yeah. Also with heavy guitars, a lot of times I'll take a direct. For the bass, usually the direct is a big part of the sound, whereas with the guitar, it's more that sometimes you need to reamp. You get a heavy section built up in a song, and the guitars are such a huge instrument. Big distorted guitars take up all this space frequency-wise. Sometimes it just doesn't work later. Yeah. And once you go back and you've got all your overdubs in the course, you got to go back and retrack the amp sound of the main guitar. But you don't want to change your performance because everyone's basing everything off the feel. So you reamp that way.
Were you using the Little Labs box to
– Yeah, I use – well – For guitar, yeah, I use the Little Labs PCP, which is...
And we should give a shout-out to that box. That is a great box if you need to record clean signal and also multiple amps.
Jonathan Little of Little Labs makes this box. It is a DI. It is a three-way splitter with independent volume control for each output to go to 3 amps, let's say, with a phase flip and a ground lift for every output. But it also has a line input on the back. So if you record using it as the DI and go into Pro Tools, it comes out of this box line level. Don't put it through a preamp. Just record it. Then you go back out of Pro Tools into the box. It comes out just like it was coming out of the guitar.
Really?
Yeah. So when you reamp, you don't. The gain is exactly the same as when you tracked it, which when you're using high gain amps or old Marshalls or things like that, a tenth of a dB completely changes the sound. So if you have to guess because you've had a DI going through a mic pre and you don't know how loud it needs to come out, it's a disaster. This box is great. For the bass, I would use the Little Labs to split, but I was actually using an Evil Twin as the DI because it's such a huge part of the sound. Mm-hmm. And that's a tube DI.
Now, what about like if you listen to records and you hear like some of the signature sounds of like the snare drum and things like that? Is that the time where you make that experimentation where, you know what, we want a really, you know, flabby-sounding snare drum, or we want a really, you know, boxy-sounding snare drum?
Yeah.
I mean, some of the stuff you have to get on the tracking.
Depends. I mean,
although I guess
some records you end up really experimenting and the snare is really different on every song.
Right.
And other records, you try doing that and I end up going back to the same snare for every single song because it's what works with the kit and with the sound of everybody else's basic instruments because those aren't really changing.
Right.
And to change the drums and not change everything else is ridiculous. And I see a lot of drummers really want to do it because they want to experiment. We've got 10 snare drums in for the studio and we're really going to go for it. But the bass player's got one amp and he's got two basses and he's playing the same ones on every song. The guitar player's got a basic setup that's going to be there. The vocalist sounds a certain way. Why would the drums necessarily be able to change underneath that if stylistically you're not making a huge change?
No, that's true.
So sometimes it doesn't work out, and sometimes it's great. And one of the things we did on Linkin Park, which was really cool, because they had started off talking about wanting to do that, but having heard the songs, I realized that there was going to be a lot of programming. But in terms of the live drums, I mean, Rob is such a loud, great rock drummer.
Thank you.
Not it's a different Rob. You as well. That we were probably going to go with a Gretsch kit, and it was going to be this one sound, and that was going to be the sound of the rock drums because it's the big Linkin Park drum sound.
Right.
So rather than let him experiment too much there, we would change cymbals a lot and change the tuning of the toms. But we set up a very small like hip hop kit next to it on the floor. Kick, snare, hat, one cymbal, no toms. Every once in a while we'd steal a tom from the other kit. 2 or 3 microphones, really heavily compressed or processed or whatever, and that became the extra drum kit. When we wanted to change it, we wouldn't even sit down behind the big kit. Just go for something totally different.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah. When you mic the snare, I was listening to the album, and it seemed like it had a great little snap to it. I mean, is that snap coming off the mics on that top head? I mean, is that basically where you get that little extra?
Yeah,
little,
I mean,
little whack.
It depends on the song too, because we changed up. Strangely, we ended up changing up the miking on the snare, sort of halfway through the tracking of the drums, just because things were changing. And we decided to go for something else. We started off with a condenser, which will give you more of that high end snap. But then we ended up with an SM7, which is a dynamic. It's used a lot for vocals, or even it's used on radio broadcasts. And the thing about it is because it's more directional, it's hypercardioid. So you don't get quite as much bleed of the rest of the kit, which was great. But also the capsule is really far back in the microphone. And nothing sounds better on drums than being able to back the mic up. You get a little bit of room and it sounds great, but then you get more bleed. But with this mic, you have to back up because it's 2 inches from the end of the microphone. So that really gives you a lot more body coming out of the snare and a lot of that crack.
Wow. Wow. What mic was that?
The SM7, wow. Sure.
And do you usually do it an over and under mic?
There's always an under mic. I usually use a 441, which is another hypercardioid.
Sure.
I almost never use it. I get enough top end out of the top snare that it sounds like the drum. But when you have a song that's got a lot of roughs and a lot of detail, then that's where you'll pick that up from.
Are you doing any kind of keying at all? You know, other mics in the room to key off of any specific drum?
No, I mean, I've got room mics all over the place when I track drums because you never quite know what you'll need and what you want. And that's where I'll change the drum sound song to song by different balance of the room mics.
Right.
So those are always recording all the time. I don't mess with those because you don't know what you're going to want. And then I also will always track some parallel compression off the kick and snare mics into an 1176 or something like that, just crushing it because that just brings out all of the noise that's going on inside the kit.
What about the kick?
Kick.
D112 or A20s?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what we ended up using. We used the D112 inside, which sounded amazing on this particular kick drum. And we used a Soundelux IFET, I believe, on the outside.
Nice.
Yeah, something like that. Pretty standard. Pretty standard mic.
Well, you did a great job. It sounds good. I picked up that album and I was like, it was great. It's a great job.
Excellent.
It's a little different Linkin Park album, but it's definitely.
Yeah, and we went through a lot of stuff. I mean, not just with the drums, with the keyboards and the amps. We must have had 30 different guitar amps up there and 50 keyboards and really just went for it. So it was good.
Great job. Well, hey, guys.
About me. What do you guys think of me?
I want to introduce you to our guest today who's sitting on the panel, and his name is Roy Ashen, and he's an independent artist, singer, songwriter. Roy, thank you for joining us.
This is where it happens.
and Roy is not only is he an independent artist, but he's also, well, for one thing, he has one of the coolest artist websites around. I mean, if you go to his website, it's really cool. And you did most of that work yourself,
all that work yourself.
It's really great. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Roy, a little bit about your career, your music.
Yes, I was born a small child and never grew much beyond that, emotionally or physically, no. Well, you know, I started playing guitar when I was 3 years old because my mom played guitar. So it goes way back. I always wanted to be a musician. I always loved music and saw Jimi Hendrix on the TV, some rerun of his performance where he's smashing his guitar, and picked up my plastic one, smashed it into the TV, and, you know, pretty much decided that this must be a cool way to have a life. So I've been writing songs and recording them as long as I've been playing one way or another. But came out to L.A. from Texas. My family's in Austin. And have released, I'm working on my fourth album right now. And along the way, you mentioned the website, part of my journey was, you know, playing in bands and wanting to go back and become a student of songwriting, become a student of making sure that the energy of the music sort of translated through everything I was doing. So that means if you're talking about a website or you're talking about a CD artwork or any of these types of things, I remember I did my first CD when I came out to LA, and I brought the CD to some design company, and they charged me a fortune, and I got it back, and I'm thinking, you know, this looks like a New Age album. I mean, it was bad, like really bad. And I, you know, I asked the guy if he listened to it, and he said, why would I need to listen to it? And so I thought, well,
wow,
this is ridiculous, you know, and how hard could it be to learn this stuff? So along the way, just, you know, it's all about storytelling. I mean, so whether it's your website or whether it's your CD artwork or whether it's your, you know, your songs or your guitar tone or the, you know, how much you compress your drums, all that stuff to me is like it's all about one thing. It's all about trying to tell the story, and that's kind of the path I'm on.
You know, you bring up a good point there with trying to find somebody to help capture your creativity, and if they're not even going to listen to the album, I mean, that's almost unforgivable, you know?
Funny you even said it, though. It's funny if you said, oh, I haven't listened to this. Should have just bluffed us out. Yeah, I love it. That's great.
Yeah, love it. Can't get enough of it, whatever it is.
I think it's worth bringing up as well with you know, Roy's passion for doing this is that he's done very, very well as an independent artist as well, you know, and since we could be signed to major labels and we wouldn't be selling as much, and it's really down to, you know, getting his passion across, and he knows totally how to do that. And that says a lot for the independent artist having a chance, you know, and doing it his own way. And Roy can prove that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about one thing that I wanted to get in with you is how you use the web, because as Martin was saying, you know, you're pretty successful as an independent album and marketing yourself.
Yeah,
to the
well,
web.
You know, it's sort of awkward sitting in a room with a bunch of Grammy winners going, yes, I'm massively successful.
No,
I even drove myself here. but I know what you mean, and it's changed a lot. I mean, when I first moved to LA, the thing was, okay, it was changing, and now you could make an indie CD pretty cheap, right? You could call it Disc Makers or whoever you want. There's lots of people that, you know, you spend a buck or two, you can press 1,000 CDs. What's changed in the last, you know, 5 years, 6 years, is that now it's really, there's a lot of great gear out there. There's a lot of ways you can tell your story from start to finish if you need to on your own. But, you know, yeah, the web has been a huge catalyst for what has been my success as an independent artist. And we were talking a little bit earlier, and the number one thing that I try and do, that same energy that you're going to use to tell the story in your song, you have to be equally real when it comes to sharing your story with fans. You know, there's so many, it's so easy to put out an album now that there's, what, 150, 100,000 records
right.
more released every couple years than there were the few years before. I mean, it's insane. And what's happening now is that everybody knows you need a website. Everybody has a MySpace page. There's a bunch of other social networks you can have pages on. But then they go and get 30,000 friends, and they get 30,000 friends and figure that, okay, great, 30,000 friends, I'm going to sell at least 20,000 albums. You know what I mean? I mean, there's this real misdirection of people's energy, and I see this with even some of my friends. So my take, I guess, trying to distill it down was two parts. Like, early on when I started, one of the albums that is a touchstone for me was Acting Baby by U2.
Right.
And I loved it because this is an album, this is a band that was massively successful already, and they went and decided to experiment. And it really inspired me because at the time I had little four-track recording kind of stuff and just thought, well, why can't you put the drum set through a distortion pedal? Why can't you, you know, try and tell the story sonically? But I was reading an interview with them, and they said the reason they thought they were continuing to be successful, even after most of their contemporaries had faded off, is that they wanted to be as good at the business as they were at the music. And that's really the core of this, is that if you love music, and I do this because, you know, the thing that thrills me more than anything is knowing that for maybe 3.5 minutes of a song, somebody had a vacation from their crappy day, and some lyric that you wrote when you were having a crappy day now becomes a soundtrack for that moment for them, and they can release that feeling that they have. But if you don't take your business part seriously, no one's ever going to have that shared crappy moment. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like,
right.
You know, you have to reach them with your music, with your message. And so, you know, part of it is communicating that through the website, communicating that. Probably the couple of most important things there is, one is, if you have a website and you're not getting people to sign up for your mailing list, you're missing, I know a lot of people that have thousands of people on their MySpace page, but if their MySpace page got hacked or cracked or they dropped their computer, they lost their password, they would lose all of that work.
That's a good point. That's a really good point on MySpace.
So, yeah, it's. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You can. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about MySpace for a second. Tell me some of the pitfalls that you see a lot of young artists and a lot of artists in general, a lot of the pitfalls that they run into, being as that was a really great one that you just mentioned. Are there anything else that you see people doing on MySpace? And
it's changed. I mean, I got on there pretty early on just because I was playing shows and we'd be playing at the Roxy or something, and all these kids would come up after me going, "You got to join MySpace," and it had just started. And early on, it was much more of a personal energy that you'd get with people. And now, what's happening is artists jump on there and they spend. Well, okay, let's just go through it specifically. They'll go to somebody else's page, and either using an automated program or one at a time, they'll just sit there and send friend requests to as many people as they can every single day. That's okay. But let's just say for a second that somebody thinks, okay, well, your picture and your friend request look kind of interesting, so I'm going to check you out. When they go to your page, what's the story? What's so great about you that I want to listen? And obviously the first thing is your music. Obviously, but beyond that is, if they like your music, what's next? Is it easy for them to buy the CD? A lot of artists, they don't make it easy for people to buy from them. They don't give them a reason to. And the other thing is, if you one of the easiest things artists can do is, if they come to your page, give them a free download in exchange for signing up for the mailing list. Give them, take a risk with them as well. Get them involved in what you're doing. And the second thing is the message that you send them. This is probably even more common. I know artists that they send this canned message that's not sincere. It just basically sounds like, it's like, hey, we're really cool, we think we're really cool, join our list. And you see all these fans say they're starting to block bands from sending them friend requests on MySpace because it's just a bunch of BS. I mean, if you're a fan and every day you log onto your page and there's 500 messages from desperate bands that think that want to sell you something, but if you look at somebody's, this is what I did, I took a lot of time you know, to do this. But I'd find people that were really interested in the kind of music that I liked, and I'd send them a message, and I'd take a second and put their name in it. Hey, you know, hey Joe, hope things are going great in Florida. I saw that you really like Britney Spears, and I'm just like her.
But only, say, only
you're doing
that.
It pretty much
a yeah, you guys can't. If you're listening to this, you can't see me. But the
it's exactly like Britney Spears from here.
It's only the clothing choices. Yeah. Right? It's more black.
But the shaved head works.
You know? Shaved head. We're both pregnant. Anyway, that but
nice cleavage.
Thank you. I've been working out. Thank you. But those are some of the obvious things, and you know. But the most common one is that they don't treat their fans like friends. They treat them like customers. And I see that daily. And, you know, the rest of it, the other part about it is just because somebody, you send somebody a friend request, excuse me, doesn't mean they're going to buy your album or like what you do. And you have to be, if you're going to spend a lot of time doing that, try and be focused about where you spend your time. Yeah, I think that's an artist right now. There's so many demands. If you're going to be an independent artist, how much time do you have in the day to make music, and how much time do you have to run your business?
Right.
And so if you're going to spend an hour, and if you tell most artists, hey, you could sell thousands of CDs if you spend an hour a day meeting people. Okay. You know, they say, okay, I'll go meet people. Where do I go meet them? Well, you know, treat people the same way that you would if you walked up to them. You know, if I saw you sitting on the street and walked up and said, hey, you know, what kind of music do you like? What are you into? Can I share something with you? Just that spirit, that energy, it may not translate to everybody, but I think it really makes a difference when you send them a message. Let them know kind of what's different about you.
Now, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because one of the best things that I like about MySpace is just the direct connection that you can have with so many people, you know. And I think that's one of the real positive things. I mean, how many people here have MySpace? I think everybody except
I don't have one.
Scott and Rob. I mean, Andrew, what's your experience on MySpace? Do you like your page? I mean, is it?
Oh, I mean, my page is ridiculous. I mean, I have friends. I would say 90% of my friends are people who are actually friends. But it's fine. It's great for me. I don't mind it, but it's kind of exciting because every once in a while some people will find me. A guy from France who I haven't seen in 15 years found me a couple of weeks ago. I was like, wow, you know, so that part of it is great. That's the actual social networking part. But
it's really cool in the sense that, you know, I just before I came out this evening, there was a couple of comments from Inverness in Scotland and, you know, a band in Dublin that, you know, were very influenced by, you know, Nick Drake and folk. And they're a good band. I played their music, and they were a good band, and they had a lot of emotion. And that's what it's great for, you know, because if people do – I think, as I was talking to Roy about in the past, if people believe in it, if there's so much going on, there's so many people out there, if they can believe in it, whether it is Britney Spears, whether it is folk, whether it's reggae, but if they can believe in it and know that you're honorable and honest about what you're doing and you've got a passion, you've really got a chance to reach out. And, you know, already I'd got a request to write songs for charity through that, which came from nowhere. And so it's a great network. If you can, as Roy said, you know, keep it under control and feel like you're looking for the right kind of communication with the fans that understand what you're doing. You know,
how hard is it to set up a MySpace page?
Oh, it's really
5 seconds.
Really yeah. Easy.
Until you want to upload something. And then,
exactly.
But I mean, this I've seen yours. I've seen most of actually everybody's with pictures and
I have
text
spent a total of 22 and a half minutes on my page.
Wow.
Including upload times. Seriously, I've spent absolutely
and then people,
no time.
And then there's an area – I'm sounding ignorant here. Then there's an area that people then can
email
you.
No, you're not sounding ignorant.
On your MySpace page?
Yeah. You go to any page and you click on a button that says, I want to be this person's friend. And it sends a request, and that's that.
What is really useful as well is, you know, if you have your own, maybe should we say professional site, where you might have much more depth of your work on, the MySpace page will, in a way, capture some people that you wouldn't have caught any other way, and you can guide them to maybe, you know, more of your work. And that, so in a way, it's like it's a little bit like the front door of your bakery, and you can lead them on to the back room where you're cooking. You know, it's got another way of getting to the bigger stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great community. I mean, mean, I look at your MySpace page, and there's a lot of people who really have been spoken to.
I've really enjoyed it, because at first I was very pessimistic about it. But, you know, I got into writing the blogs every month, and people were getting into the books I was reading and into the things I cared about. That was really, really beneficial. And I have found a few artists that I think are really good, and I make a point of saying, your music's great. Yeah, and I really feel that.
That's a huge thing that you're sort of tapping into, which is, again, it's the personal energy is if you treat it just like a big advertisement and every email you get about saying, hey, I think you're great, and you turn around and you say, my CD's only $9.99.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's not really what people
got. Personalize it.
Yeah. Right. The reason MySpace became successful so quickly early on, now it's, you know, in danger of becoming a spam fest, is that, you know, early on people would email you and go, oh my God, you know, I bought your CD when I was on vacation in Japan, and now I'm actually getting to send you a message and tell you that track three really meant something to me. You can respond. Yes. For a lot of artists, just taking the time, it doesn't have to be your, you know, 20-minute email, just responding and that they can communicate with you is what makes it so exciting for people who love music.
Is this something which, you know, over the years I've seen different styles of music, and it seemed like country music always was very much trying to reach out to their fans and be very accessible. Meanwhile, you know, it's like, let's be part of it. Meanwhile, I think a lot of pop and even rock music's more like, watch me, look at me.
Right.
Aren't I great?
Adore me.
Other than that, I don't want to hear from you.
Yeah.
And now it's all about, you know, just reaching out and touching your fans.
A lot of the savvier artists are even taking little digital video camera, going to rehearsal and creating messages like, hey, what's up? I'm in the studio. I'm in rehearsal. Yeah. And they'll post it because you can easily post videos as well. And some friends of mine are starting to do more and more of that, and it's turning out to work well for them to engage fans, because it's, you know, it's a world of reality TV, so people are used to going behind the scenes. Every movie DVD now comes with how they made it. Mm-hmm. So sort of people are getting used to looking behind the veil, and for an artist to take people on the story of making an album, it's something we've been doing, and I've been going to the studio recording and documenting all this stuff. So, you know, it's like Martin and I were talking, the Monty Python Eric Idle quote where he says, I've suffered for my music and now it's your turn.
Why did he look at me when he said that?
We all looked at you.
You wrote the music.
Hey, Bobby, your MySpace page. Do you use it a lot? Do you look at it a lot?
23 minutes. That's been done. And 22 of it was trying to get a track to upload. That was it.
This is a real, real point, actually. I mean, I'm having great difficulty in getting more than one song up, you know, but I just can't, and Bobby's been trying to help me with it. Bobby can't get his material up as well. They've actually blocked me at this point, you know, just because they don't believe it's my music.
No, they listen to it.
Maybe that's it, Bobby. Thank you. I'll leave now. But it's come to the point where, and Mike was trying to help me as well, they've blocked me, and we don't really know why, except for you've got a philosophy on this, Mike. This is a good point. You know, we're having great difficulties in trying to get extra tracks up. Now we can't even put extra photographs up. We've just got a block on all creativity.
A block from whom?
From MySpace.
I
own the songs, I own the masters, I own the copyrights, but for some reason, I think, Mike, you had a thought of this, didn't you? The waveforms.
Well, they use
Grace Note.
They use song identification technology, basically like waveform recognition technology. And so since Martin's a, you know, commercial artist, they've flagged his songs, you know, and
well,
I mean, I post this stuff up for a test. I'll put a 1K test tone up there.
I thought you were going to say you post all Martin's music when he's not paying attention.
Well, and his computer exploded.
But you know what? I mean, I'm wondering after the first time, because...
Bobby's putting up demos and he's putting up tones on his own site.
On your own site.
Yeah. Well, MySpace is notorious for growing faster than they can keep up. So a lot of their there's been times where the whole site goes down. But I was thinking earlier today that a great workaround, Martin, would be that you can easily post MP3s on your site, and we'll set up a streaming player. You can embed it in your page, and you can put anything you want. You don't have to deal with their audio.
Well, we thought if we put another player on it, Roy, that it would still have to go through MySpace, and MySpace would see this embedded player. And
no, they
just say make create more of a link, so it automatically.
Because it would still stream from your website.
Yeah, you can from my website.
You can embed a little Flash movie player that'll run.
But that's why I'm working with Roy. You see, he's got all these great ideas.
But have you read? Because I was doing some reading that they are now going to approve certain Flash players and other Flash players because they want to make sure whether or not you use the Grace Note,
they're trying to do some of that.
Fingerprinting technology.
They're really more concerned with these big sites that are trying to steal their traffic, right? So they bought a company called PhotoBucket because PhotoBucket was becoming more popular for photo sharing than MySpace, and so you might as well just buy them. You got the money. But in a case of a single artist putting up their own flash player to stream a handful of songs, they're not going to pay attention to that. But I know what you're talking about. If we started a company called, you know, Westwave Widgets, and we wanted to put something up that was violating their terms of service, whatever that means, you know,
right,
whatever, they'd probably find a way to try and extort a little money from you.
That's
Rupert Murdoch would.
Mr. Rodriguez.
That's right. All right. Well, hey, guys, we're going to take a break right now, and we're going to continue visiting with Roy on the other side, and then that's some other really great stuff to talk about. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and we're here continuing with Roy Ashen, independent artist, singer, songwriter, web guru.
Professional juggler.
But, so Roy, before the break, we were talking a little bit about MySpace and some of the problems that independent bands run into trying to use MySpace. But, let's look at the bigger picture. How do you become, you know, what's...
How do you literally make hundreds of dollars in this business?
Yeah, but what's the secret? I mean, in your opinion, how do you break out and start selling CDs? And,
right,
you know, you don't, not even getting huge, just starting selling, a couple thousand CDs.
Well, I guess, you know, the starting place is I grew up playing in bands when I came out to LA, and I was in bands. The last band was called the Crash Poets, and we sold a lot of CDs. But we first started, we got in the habit of spending a lot of time in rooms with major label NR people shopping demos and waiting. And it's really a bad use of most artists' time. So what we did is we went away and we said, let's look at all of the roles that the people that we admire, might as well start at the top, say someone like U2, what are all the people that they have around them to make things happen? And they have a manager, they have a booking agent to book gigs, they have a record label that handles sales and marketing and maybe distribution, they have maybe a producer or a great mixer to make sure that whatever they start with their music, it finishes sounding as good as it can. They have a publisher to help them play songs in TV and film. They have maybe a publicist to help them get some press. And last but not least, they have an attorney so they don't get screwed when they do these licensing deals. So we made this little chart and we said, here are all the roles that the reason everybody wants a record deal is they want someone to do all that crap for them. Right? That's a big part of it, among other things. They don't want to do any of that stuff. But if you're going to be successful and you don't want to make it like a lottery, you don't want to be lucky, you want to be successful, you either have to find those people or you have to be those people. And that kind of really freaks a lot of artists out. But it's not like you give up your artistry. It's just a certain amount of time each day. And that time could be an hour. But if you make a chart of all those positions, so to speak, and you say, okay, what's important to me right now? Well, I'm making an album right now. That's what I'm doing. So right now I don't have to worry about a publicist, or I don't have to worry necessarily about an attorney or whatever it is. I'm now in mixing, producing mode. Getting to that point, then as I start preparing the record, now I got to start thinking about the places I'm going to promote it. And if you start thinking about all those different roles, and you even spend an hour a day, you make a couple of phone calls to expand your network, you read a couple of magazines and find out who's doing stuff that you're doing and who you can network with. You go find other bands, send a few emails, make a few calls to see if you can be the opener on their tour. If you take as many steps in the business side as you do on the music side, you're going to find your audience, because no one can tell you that's the beauty of the world we live in right now. Nobody can tell you that you're not going to be successful. Nobody can tell you that your music sucks, because even if it does, there's a market for that too.
Right?
I mean, we're all here.
but that's really the thing is, I have a big problem with the sort of helpless, poverty-stricken mentality of a lot of artists, because I think that it's their life of people telling them, well, you know how hard this business is.
Right.
And it's like, they're not doing it because it's hard or it's easy. They're doing it because they love it. They do it because the songs that are resonating inside them have to come out. And if they just get a little bit organized, you don't have to be an MBA, you don't have to be a Harvard person. And along the way, if you start taking these steps, when you meet successful people in the business,
right,
they're going to go, you've done all this on your own? maybe there's a reason for us to work together. Right. Maybe, maybe not, right? But you're never putting all of it on this sort of roll the dice attitude. And I've had friends on major labels, and they're still calling me asking for loans because they're waiting to get their check because they still haven't recouped. So there's, you know, there's a lot of reasons why if you're successful as an independent artist, you could upstream if you want, or you could keep making money from TV and film and selling CDs or selling digital downloads. But that's, you know, if you look at, I mean, you know, I heard you a few of the podcasts you guys talk about books. You've probably mentioned this to independent artists before, but if you're going to read, check out two different sort of publications. One is Donald Passman's book, All You Need to Know About the Music Business. Donald Passman, you can find it on Amazon. It's kind of like the Bible. Yep. And it's like, it's actually reasonably easy to read, even though it's written by an attorney. But it tells you how all these different parts of the industry, what the moving parts are. And the second one is, you had Rich Ezra on recently. Rich is a friend of mine.
Right.
Very, very smart guy. And he has this site called musicregistry.com. And he has all these books that tell you who the publishers and A&R people at major and independent labels are, who the attorneys are, who the producers and mixers are. You don't want to get the book and start spamming all these people with emails before you're ready. But when you are ready and you've done some of these steps and you have a story to tell and some momentum, you can at least reach out to these people. So,
you know, it's amazing that I think artists need to keep in mind is just how big the internet is and how many people you can actually reach. I mean, it's just, it's phenomenal how many eyes are on MySpace. When we started this podcast, I mean, half the fun for me was just going and checking out the stats and seeing the countries that were, and hey, we've got 10 listeners in this country and we've got 25 listeners here and we've got, you know, hundreds of listeners over in like the UK and stuff. It's just amazing how, as small as this planet is, there's just a lot of people out there.
And there's a lot of social networks that are popping up. If for the people that are listening, if you're not on them already and you're looking for places that maybe are a little fresher, you know, obviously you've heard of Friendster, which was pre-MySpace, but now there's Facebook, which is opening up. There's Bebo, B-E-B-O. There's Hi5, it's H-I-5.com. You know, just go to Wikipedia and .org and type in social networks, and you'll see a list of the top ones, and there's like hundreds of them all over the world. And each one is an opportunity to make friends. And if you don't have enough time to manage all this yourself, this is the whole thing about outsourcing too. Maybe you have some fans like Martin does that are willing to come in and help maintain some of these pages for you. People that you trust that love what you're doing. That they don't. It's not about money. They just want to help. So you can empower people because nobody, even with what I just said, no single artist can do it all themselves. Like Andrew, we were talking about U2 and some of these bands, and they surround themselves with tons and tons of great people. And you can do that as an independent artist too. Find this team of people that believe in you and let them help.
Well, that, you know, that's so true because you also find just the cream of the crop of people. I mean, we got to give a shout out to Vanessa, you know,
handles
the MySpace page for both the Audio Nowcast and I know Martin, and she's just top notch and she gets things done, and there's a lot of people. If you can get a team of people that really, you know, believe in your project, it's fantastic.
That's the word, really, team. You know, you can find the people that work well with you and that you can get on with, and you know that their passion's in the right place. So you know that's another skill you have to work, you know, realize that what's going to be the strength for you. Pick the right team. Also, what Roy was saying there is I think all of us around the table, you tend to grow up loving music, but you do a bit of everything, don't you? You know, you're a roadie at the beginning. You know,
I still am.
You still are, Bobby. Yeah, yeah. And you know, and you learn to play more than one instrument. You learn to do a little bit of engineering because you work on your four track at home. You learn a little bit of technology, and you manage yourself to a certain degree. You know, and it's really, really advisable to put your hand into it as much as you can around just the music business, because you'll just move a more healthy space, you know. And I think everybody is doing that, but they don't realize they are. And as Roy said, you know, you've got to believe that you can do more than you think you can.
Definitely the music business as well. It's 90% business and 10% music. Really. Yeah.
Well, if you're consistent, you know, that's the thing is most people, they, like, you know, you want to go, I have a friend, bass player in my band, the guy's amazing bass player, and he blows my mind because he set out to start running marathons. And he had a great point. He said, nobody goes out and runs a marathon the first day. You're going to hurt yourself and you'll give up. And it's the same thing true for writing songs, for producing, for being in the business. just run, you know, just start off, take a few steps every single day, and you'll get stronger at each one of these things you're doing. You'll find out what you're good at.
Yeah.
And the things that you're not good at or you just don't have a feel for, you find those people, you find those.
That's a great point about also, you know, not thinking you could do everything, but realizing having a, you know, the looking at people's strengths is a big thing. You know, knowing that, you know, as we say with Vanessa, she's wonderful at helping us with our websites and has the energy to do it better than we could and sees opportunities, and then finding the right engineer that's going to help you, you know, extend your music, and the right producer. So it's also a skill to try and find the right strengths to surround yourself with. Learn about your weaknesses, you know, be aware of your weaknesses.
Well, I've had a lot of conversations with independent artists and new artists that I've worked with, and I'll always say to them, exactly, what do you think? Because everybody thinks they need a big record deal when they're starting out. And I'll just say, okay, what is it exactly you think the record company is going to do for you that you shouldn't be doing for yourself? Basically, the only answer that is valid is, well, if I get a huge record deal, they'll give me a bunch of money. Well, and that's true, and you may never ever pay that back. You know, they could recoup it five times over and still tell you you owe them the money. But in the short term, you might get a chunk of cash, which is true. The label may give you that, and you'll pay for it.
You'll never own your music again.
Never. But outside of that, what is it you're expecting a label to do for you that you can't do for yourself? And the answer these days is absolutely nothing.
No.
I mean, with a little bit of cleverness and putting together the right team.
And in fact, I think we probably all did the same thing, but I used to sign publishing deals to get an advance so that I could buy a studio and run my own songs. Out of all the years I've written, I've maybe got one or two songs cut through a publisher. It's been through relationships. And the money I used from advances was to be able to promote myself.
Right.
And we all have to do that.
All the independent artists that are friends of mine that, and again, you know, I love that I get to do this, and I, like you guys, I'm always trying to learn and surround myself with great people and keep growing my network. But a lot of my friends that are independent artists or new friends that are just getting started, I ask one question that kind of freaks them out, and I'll just say, if you're talking to a new artist or an independent artist and you say, if I told you that you're never, ever, ever, ever going to get a major label record deal, are you going to quit?
Mm-hmm.
And get over it. You know, that's kind of this thing. If you resolve yourself to making music and keep moving down the field, moving forward with what you love and what you do, either that will happen and it will be the right situation, or you'll be successful and you'll have this, you know, do you need a million people to buy your CD and you make a buck a piece? Or do you need 100,000 fans that buy everything that you'll ever put out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people sort of have that, you know, touch me with the magic wand mentality, you know, where it's just someone's going to sign the deal and it's all better. But if you're probably everybody in this room has seen the 9 times out of 10 on big record labels where that doesn't happen. It doesn't mean that the people weren't talented. Mm-hmm. It's just the stars maybe didn't align on that one. But there's a lot of artists out there that are making $250,000 a year and you've never heard of them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Independently.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, that brings up another point is the economics of the whole industry has really has changed. It's not the same. It's not on the same scale anymore. I mean, you can make a living selling, you know, tens of thousands, you know, 5,000, 6,000 if you keep producing and you get people that keep buying.
There's room for all of it. I mean, that's the whole thing is, you know, there's a lot of the artists that are the biggest artists in the world right now that were the most enterprising people to start with. They, like you guys were talking, you know, they did all that work. They were out there panning out the flyers and recording the demos, and, you know, even like guys like Linkin Park. I mean, they know what they're doing. They learn their instruments. They learn how to edit, and they learned about Pro Tools, I'm guessing, and, you know, really worked to get where they're getting. I mean, some of it might be luck, but you don't want to base your whole life on luck.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a viable independent record now, I mean, you know, what, 10,000 units? You know, if you're keeping, you know, most of that profit being independent, I mean, that's not change, you know, it's not jump change.
Making $7, $8, $9 selling it for 12 or 13. If you have 10,000 people here's the real interesting thing. If you have 10,000 people that bought your record and you collected all of their email addresses, now you can sell them a t-shirt. Now you can sell them a DVD of the live show. You go record, you know, the gig on, you know, on Melrose, you go and play a show, they let you videotape it, you put out a DVD and you sell 1,000 for $20. You know what I mean? There's a lot of ways, you know, just, you know, that if you can control the output of your music, and at the same time, if you can have a direct relationship with these people, that's why the mailing list thing is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is if you have, again, 10,000 people on your mailing list, and you can sell even, you know, a live, you do a live acoustic show, right. Put that out. Whatever it is, there's a lot of ways that if you can have that relationship, you can do pretty well.
Now, let me ask you, let's go back to MySpace for one second. You know, MySpace Music, to me, seems still a really great, viable site for a band.
Yeah.
You know, MySpace,
it's
on personal
places.
Ones, it's, yeah. You know, it's a spam fest, but on MySpace Music, it just seems like it's a great place to be as a band. How does that compare to, like, Facebook or some of these other ones that, I mean, I looked at Facebook and Facebook just seemed a little closed.
Antiseptic, yeah.
Yeah. And, like, let's say Rob wants to put out a social networking site. I mean, would you still say, yeah, Rob, go to MySpace Music, or would you recommend any of the other ones above MySpace Music?
No, I think, well, MySpace is still the first place people are going to look for if you're in a band, you know. Everybody, it's like as an independent artist, there are certain things you just, everybody does, and that's one of them now. Maybe at some point it'll be something else. But right now, it's if you go to MySpace, everybody's on there. The question just comes to when people visit your page, is it just a place for them to listen to a couple songs, or is it a place where you can maybe start a deeper relationship with them? So, yeah, you still need to be on there. Again, it's just a matter of how much time you put into that. If it takes you 20 minutes to build, you don't need to spend – this isn't just my opinion, but I see a lot of artists that are now turning their pages because they're following what the major label artists are doing, and their pages are tons of billboards for their album, and here's the banner ads, and here's 50 different widgets, and you go there, and it's just overwhelming. It feels like a big shopping site as opposed to, hey.
Well, half the time it looks as though it's ads for something else.
Right.
You don't even realize that it's for their own thing.
That's right.
Because you don't read it. You're so used to not reading the advertising.
You just don't want to go in.
I mean,
you don't
want to
go in.
Do you want 50,000 friends who accepted your friend request and could care less about anything that you ever do? Or would you rather have 3,000 or 4,000 friends and these are people that really love what you're doing? And that's, if you're building that, if you take that approach, you're quite likely after MySpace ceases to become this, you know, the gotta be place, you're still going to have a relationship with these people. But it's definitely, you still got, if you're a new band, it's a great place to sort of try out your stuff and start seeing what people think about you.
Where do you think the point is of, like, diminishing returns on the number of friends that you get? Because you look at some of these bands that have 113,000 friends, or, you know, some of the more popular ones, and you're like, you know, they're not answering all that email.
Yeah, I have 14 or 15,000 earned the old-fashioned way one at a time, but over the last couple of years, and even I get overwhelmed. And what I just have to do is sort of compartmentalize it. I can't be on there. It's a real time suck. You could get on there at midnight and you're up till 4 or 5 in the morning answering emails. I'll put in like 20 minutes a day, that kind of a thing. But the diminishing return is not about the number of people you have.
Right.
It's about the quality of the relationship.
Right.
Like imagine this. Say you started your MySpace page today and it was really easy for people to get on your mailing list, or
right.
they got a free download or something.
Right.
Well, if you had 100,000 people and now you've ported 50,000 of them to your personal email list, and now you can send an email directly to them because MySpace doesn't allow you to do that. You can blast out a monthly newsletter that really has something interesting going on, or you can take people on the journey of making your album. And even for me, it's still a challenge. I mean, you know, I'm certainly not up on a pedestal. I mean, I have the same challenges of 24 hours a day that everybody else does, so I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to use this the best to mess with my ability as well. But that's probably the real thing, is that a lot of people, they go get the program and they start automating friend requests, and they sent friend requests to 50,000 people, and now that actually might start becoming a turnoff to someone who feels like fans feel like you don't care about them.
Right.
I mean, that was the whole idea of music on MySpace when it first started, is, wow, I could email this band and maybe they'll email me back, and now it's like, it's not even, I don't even believe it's them I'm emailing. If you have that problem, you're not going to see a great response from your, you know. I mean, the whole idea is that when people first started, they figured if I got 150,000 friends, I'd get a record deal. But now what's happening is all the record labels, indie labels and major labels go, okay, you got 150,000 friends. If you haven't sold any CDs to those people, well, that tells me something too, doesn't it? You know?
So, let me just ask you, Roy, with the friends that you had, did that transcend into good sales? Did you find that it was the real fans were there?
Yeah, I've sold a few thousand to those people, and the couple things that I think made a difference was just being real with people. If they emailed you a question, answer the question.
Right.
Like, answer the question. Don't say, that's great, my CD's $9.99 at, you know, CD Baby or whatever. The other part about it was asking for their help. There's something really genuine about being real with people. Sorry, the coffee's kicking in. But if you're real with people and you believe that you have something meaningful to say, not that you just want to sell something and there are means to an end. If people pick up on that stuff big time, you know. Yeah. And so I would just say, someone send me a message and say, hey, look, I don't even know if you like this kind of music. I think you might. If you do, I'd love to know what you think. I'd love to know what songs you like. And I'd love a little bit of your support. If you do like what you're doing, my album's available. And if make sure and let me know you bought it. I'll personally sign it. And I'll put a copy of my music video so the girls from Buffy the Vampire Slayer is in, or whatever, that was part of the last record. And people were, you'd send the CD and you'd put a little personal note in there. It only takes a minute, you know, and then they post on your post on your page, oh my God, I can't believe you sent that letter. Thank you. It really meant a lot to me. And they are now your friends.
Stay there,
they're really, like, you know, like Andrew said, all the people on his, you said the people on your page, they're really your friends. It's
for
like
the most part,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of something. If it may be harder as you get busier to maintain that, but you should try.
What is the actual mechanism for selling them the music once you've become friends with them for real and they want to buy it?
Where do they buy it? Well, in my case, I sell it myself because I make a whole lot more money and I get the data of who's buying it, where they're from. I'm a little more tech savvy.
So did you actually code your own e-commerce site?
It's just, you just PayPal right now. I mean, I actually had I took it down. I'm rebuilding something right now that will serve digital downloads on my site. And I'm actually involved with a company that's developing some pretty cool tools for any musician, which is in top secret mode, but I will be back to talk about that because I think there's some great stuff on the way. But right now there's so many services that, you know, you can sell digital downloads through MySpace themselves. You can sell through all the obvious places like CD Baby. The only place I tend not to recommend, though, I'm on there, is Amazon.com, because if you buy from Amazon, Amazon won't tell you who bought it. And if you don't know who bought it, you can't send them a thank you note. You can't enroll them into what you're doing. So there's something really nice about controlling the flow. If an independent band, of saying, okay, I got in 30 CD orders this week. Well, each one of those, I have a stack of note cards that have my little logo on there, and I just put a quick note in there, and I put it in there. And the other thing that's really great is if you burn, say you have 1,000 sampler CDs that have parts of all the songs, or maybe one or two free tracks, throw 3 or 4 of those in there with every single order, and your fans will distribute that to other people that are good friends of theirs and say, hey, I love this guy. Why don't you check it out? If you like it, you can buy a CD. And letting people know that you're really trying to build something and you really value what that interaction, and for every one CD that you sell that way, you'll sell 2 or 3 more over the next year because they're going to give those sampler CDs to their friends.
That's a great idea. A lot of ISPs too, when you set up websites, you know, they have the tools that come in the whole bundle. You know,
PayPal is really easy these days too. You can, like, if you're on MySpace, go sign up for a free PayPal account. There's a little wizard that you decide how much you want to charge, and then it gives you a little button. You can paste that code onto your MySpace page, and people can buy it straight from your MySpace page.
Yeah, selling the stuff is easy now, because there's also a company called Snowcap makes it looks exactly like the media player that goes into MySpace, but it has a buy now button where they can download from there. All of the digital distribution, iTunes, CD Baby, all of those are available incredibly easily, but the big thing is, as you said, they all take a cut.
Right.
So you need to research and you need to decide how much you want to do yourself to keep the money.
Exactly. If you
don't want to, that's the thing you're terrible at. Fine. Pay someone to do it. It's that's a good decision to make if you're bad at it.
That's right.
No, that's true. Really quick, we're running out of time, but Scott, you ever think social networking will be important in film as it is in the music scene? You ever see that coming?
Oh, no. I mean, what is it, Lincoln?
LinkedIn.
I mean, right now, it's huge. I mean, exponentially, the LinkedIn stuff is going crazy with people that I know and people that have been finding me, and especially on the video game side and the movie side a little less, but the video game side's huge.
So it's keeping up with technology.
And also, what happens is people keep moving to different companies.
Right.
And they keep moving to all over the place. And then what happens is you get access to their contacts. They get access to your contacts. All of a sudden, I went from 2 people to now I've got like 500 people that I'm, and they're all like major players in the business. And sometimes I'll go in and I'll go, wow, I just found out like one of the head creative people, Mattel. You know, just weird, weird coincidences and you start linking in.
LinkedIn.com. That's a great site for business networking.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, hey, Roy, thank you so much. This has been fantastic, and you've just given a ton of great advice to a lot of people out there. Heck, you've given a ton of advice to me. But, let's hear it for Roy.
I just have to say as well, I've been lucky enough to hear some of the tracks of his new album, and it's pretty exceptional, and it's really great stuff.
And what is the URL to go and hear your music?
Thank you. Well, you know, the site is Roy Ashen, ROYASHEN.com, or myspace.com/ Roy Ashen. The new music isn't up there, and it's quite a departure from the previous album. But, you know, if anybody's listening, if you have any questions on what we were talking about, hey, it's all about hooking people up. So share and share alike. Just shoot me an email.
Yeah, do you want to give out your email address?
Or? Sure. It's ashenproductions@aol.com.
Great. So we will send you all information.
Dear Roy, what's right. Martin's home address?
No, you're going
to give you that.
The first six.
For cash.
The first six emails are going to be from everybody sitting on the table.
Yeah,
I need help with my site.
Hey, bring it on.
Hey, before we go, I want to just mention a couple things. Number one, I believe a piece of hardware arrived, Andrew. Do you want to describe? Come on, because you took us through the whole awards.
Well, it's true. Okay. Andrew. All right. So for those of you who may be following along at home, after the Grammy ceremony, the Chili Peppers record that I worked on won Rock Album of the Year, and there was much debate as to whether, do I get a certificate? Do I get a statue? And then as my wife and children informed me over the phone when I was at the studio one day, I did indeed get a statue.
Go!
You're going to have to at least bring it in. So
we have a photograph of this.
It's the closest any of us are going to get to one.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. No, so it's pretty great. And what's really cool about it is it's just heavy enough and just big enough that it's not gaudy, but it's like, man, that's a Grammy award. So I didn't know what to do with it, so I actually brought it out to the studio, and it's just sitting on the bookshelves.
That's
but
awesome.
It turns
that's cool.
out it's in a really good place because it's on some bookshelves with a cabinet underneath, and all the water bottles are in the cabin underneath, so people get thirsty.
Yeah.
The water is over there, just under the ground.
and did I tell you my fee's gone up?
Yeah.
Before they give you any crap, they've got to
exactly.
go there and
no,
get
it's
some water.
Very, very cool.
Everybody says, you think your vocal's loud enough, you just point at the Grammy, go.
But speaking of awards, somebody's got an award show coming up.
That's the cross-dressing award show.
No.
Bobby, what, in 2 weeks, daytime Emmys?
Yep, supposedly. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So we'll...
See? Yep.
You can borrow my red carpet.
You know something? That's not a bad idea. I need it because you couldn't find it last time.
No. But they gave me one, so I have one.
Great.
I'll give it to you.
Yeah, maybe I'll get the red carpet instead of anything.
Yeah.
No one leaves home empty-handed.
And then, Rob, you got a certificate. A
gracious.
Certificate.
I did. All these awards. Yeah. Gracious.
I got... mild recognition. No, I was actually really excited because I truly wasn't expecting it. But we did some recording for Peter Frampton's last album at my place, Fingerprints album, and it won the Grammy for Best Pop Instrumental this year. And I didn't realize it, but because I was listed as an engineer, I was eligible for a Grammy certificate. So this thing showed up with big gold logo and everything else, and I got really excited.
That's awesome. Good for you.
All right.
So thank you, Peter. I already did thank him, but I'm going to be thanking him plenty. That was nice.
All right. Well, hey, we're going to have to wrap things up here, but anybody got anything interesting they're working on? Anybody? Scott, I know you're on the stage, mixing.
Yeah, I'm finishing up Shoot 'Em Up, and literally it's been a wild week because I started also on Ela. In the Valley of Ela, sorry. And I'll be doing that until August. So it's like when I'm juggling and I'm overlapping two projects. So it's been pretty crazy.
That's great.
Did my ringtone make it?
Yeah, it did. It
okay,
did.
Am I allowed to talk about it?
Yeah.
Because I'm never allowed to talk about anything. Can
yes.
I talk about that?
Talk about it.
Sheesh, sure, you talk about it. As long as it's about me, I don't care who's telling the story.
What happened was Paul Giamatti in the project has a ringtone. And what the movie's called Shoot 'Em Up. It's Clive Owen, Paul Giamatti. And there's an underlining theme to it that it's pretty much like a Bugs Bunny real life cartoon. It's kind of like Kill Bill with guns.
Right.
And so the director wanted to do something kind of cool. And originally we tried to get the Warner Brothers theme, Warner Brothers cartoon theme. And they, I don't know, for whatever reason, it didn't work out. So we did, what was it, Ride of the Valkyries?
Mm-hmm.
Basically,
it which was, they know as Kill the Rabbit.
Kill the Rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kill the Rabbit, Kill the Rabbit. So and it's an ongoing joke through the whole film that the ringtone happens. So we needed to create a ringtone that would have fit Paul's personality. So I called my buddy Rob, and the director and I came down,
and it was a lot of fun. It wasn't the most, you know, intense musical project, but it was really cool.
Yeah. You know, but it's funny, though, even though it sounds, you know, it's not, theoretically not that hard, but at the same time, we needed to get the sound and the right instrumentation to be corny enough, because it's a comedy thing.
Well, that's how you called Rob for that.
We need corny and not that difficult? Yeah. It's tricky to get the sound right because
it was, yeah.
The whole idea is it's supposed to push the comedy in the film but not draw any attention to itself. Like, you have to believe it would be coming out of his phone.
And it's also fun. Like, Vienna Library, no. Synth Library, no. You needed this old, almost FME type of sound, and you think about all the cool things that you've bought in the last 2 years, and that ain't any of it. So it had to go really retro, and then we had to worldize it to make it feel like it's actually coming from a phone. So I did a little futz, did the play, and we did all the Rob's house. It was amazing.
It was fun.
Well, that's great, and I'm going to go see it just to hear the.
Oh, me too.
You should sell the ringtone on your site.
There you go. You see, that came from Roy.
Yeah, exactly. That is public domain. Yeah.
Cha-ching.
All right. Well, that's great. And Martin, I know we're working on your EPK.
Yeah, it was a good weekend. We did. Well, actually, you were helping me with that, Mike. So yeah. We did all day filming at my place. Some of the songs and some of the stories behind the new album. That was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah. That's going to be really
speaking
good.
Of new albums, since you were so kind to throw some praise my way, I'm sure you guys, I don't know if any of you guys have heard Martin's new record, but it is stunning.
Thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate that.
It's just
thank you.
Coming from another songwriter, the energy and the soulfulness that's in these songs, I think people are going to really, you're going to see some incredible responses from this.
Thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate that.
Of course, the artwork's beautiful.
Of course, because you're designing it.
Well, I want to do a really quick plug. I mixed a documentary for a friend of mine, Chris Perkel, and it's called The Town That Was, and that's going to be screening at the L.A. Film Festival.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's Chris's film, and it's just really great. It's about the Centralia, Pennsylvania. They had a coal fire that's been burning for like 30 years or something like that, 27 years. Yeah, it's really good, and he just got a great angle, and I just want to give him all the props because he did a really great job. All right, gang. Well,
nobody cares
again.
What I'm up to, really.
What are you up to, Rob?
You've got no big award, man.
Andrew.
Well, no, I just wanted to mention that sure. I just finished mixing a record for this English band Fight Star. Very rocking. And,
cool.
The first single's already out because we mixed that a while ago, and the whole thing will be coming out. But they're touring the States right now, opening for Funeral for a Friend.
Nice. Well,
that's great.
And they'll be in L.A. later in the month. So.
That's great. Okay, well, once again, thanks, Roy, for giving us some great advice.
Thank you.
Yeah. And guys, let's try to make it 5 in a row next time. Yeah. All right, from everybody here at the Audio Nowcast, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.